This is the Read to Lead podcast, episode 186.
Hi, I'm Christopher Lockhead, co-author of Play Bigger, How Pirates, Dreamers, and Innovators Create and Dominate Markets, and co-host of the Legends and Losers podcast. If you want to play bigger, be sure and include this show as part of your weekly routine. It's the Read to Lead podcast with my friend, Jeff Brown.
When we're in an organization that has dysfunction or politics, nobody wants it. Everybody hates it. And almost nobody sees how we're all inadvertently and involuntarily perpetuating the system.
Welcome to the Read to Lead podcast with Jeff Brown. Jeff believes that if you desire to achieve true success in business and in life, then consistent and intentional reading is a must. The Read to Lead podcast will not only help you narrow this ever-important reading list, but also bring you key insights and valuable feedback from some of today's most successful and inspiring authors. And now, here's Jeff.
Hi, and welcome once again to the podcast that's dedicated to your personal and professional growth. The topic of leadership is, of course, always central to our discussion, and that is indeed the case today, as in a moment, you and I are going to be joined by a guy named Shane Hughes. He's the co-author of a book called Ego-Free Leadership, Ending the Unconscious Habits That Hijack Your Business. I'll be asking Shane to share about his thoughts on our preoccupation with self-worth, the power that empathy and vulnerability can bring to the workplace, how events from our childhood impact behavioral patterns that then impact the course of our life, and plenty more. You know, yesterday I sent out an email to my list marking last night at 11:59 Central Time, the deadline to let me know about your desire to submit an application to my new mastermind group launching in November. And it occurred to me as I was putting the finishing touches on this episode that I haven't mentioned it at all on the podcast. So maybe I better do that before I stop taking applications. So here's the deal. Those on my email list have got a bit of a head start on you, but all you need to do is send me an email and let me know you desire to fill out an application to be a part of my new exclusive mastermind group launching next month. Send that email to jeff@readtoleadpodcast.com and just put mastermind in the subject line. I'll reply with a link to that application and also a website with all the details. Now, I already have more applicants than I have slots to fill. And so over the coming days, I've got my work cut out for me in determining who is going to be ultimately in our group. But if you desire clarity in your business journey, if you are thrilled with the idea of collaborating with other respected influencers and peers, if you're self-aware enough to know you have room to improve and you welcome having others you trust critique your work, if you long for the confidence to know beyond a doubt that you're headed in the right direction, then you may be the perfect fit for a group like this. So send me an email, jeff@readtoleadpodcast.com with mastermind in the subject line right away, and I'll be sure to get you those details on how you can apply for one of the 10 slots. Shane Hughes is president of Learning as Leadership, a cultural change and leadership development firm serving the private and public sectors. His expertise in creating cultures of open communication and collaboration has helped lead to substantial improvements in organization and personal performance for clients like Fairchild Semiconductor, NASA, Shell Oil, a whole lot of others. His writing has been published in a number of publications, including Forbes and Chief Executive Magazine, and he blogs for the Huffington Post, by the way. His latest book, co-written with Brandon Black, is called Ego-Free Leadership, Ending the Unconscious Habits That Hijack Our Business. Shane, it's a pleasure. Welcome officially to the Read to Lead podcast.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Well, I have thoroughly enjoyed this book, and it reminds me of some of those sort of business parables that you read from the likes of Bob Berg, you know, Go Giver, or Ken Blanchard. I really love how you and Brandon have managed to weave story throughout as you share these concepts, and the stories do such a fantastic job of illustrating the concepts in real world settings.
Thank you. You cut out for a little bit, so I'm expressing gratitude for a statement that I mostly missed. It sounded positive.
It was overwhelmingly positive. You'll have to come back and listen to it later. It was awesome. Okay. Well, hopefully that's not the norm here as we move along, but I'll attempt to jump into the first question. I'd love for you, Shane, to describe some of this ground you cover right at the very beginning of the book in chapter one, including our preoccupation with things like self-worth, things that hijack our behaviors, you know, the desired and dreaded images duos that you talk about, and how to recognize this behavior in ourselves when it's happening.
Yeah, you know, maybe the way to describe that most simply is through my own experience. So I started doing this work when I was an undergrad about 25 years ago, and I had I was going to UC Berkeley. I was a pretty good student, but I had one fatal flaw that really held me back, that I really actually felt was more like a personality trait. And that was just a real problematic lack of discipline that in particular showed up as a procrastination problem. So I would have papers to write for my major, my field of study, and as the date approached, I would just know each morning as I got up, I got to work on this. And I would delay it and delay it and delay it until finally the night before it was due, I would, in a mad dash of stress productivity, write the thing and hand it in. And so I always handed things in on time. Nothing was ever late, but it was always, in essence, not my best work. And it was really aggravating because I thought to myself, if I could just start earlier, I could do such a good job. Like, why can't I do this? This is terrible. And at some point, we get quite judgmental about my lack of discipline and follow through, and had stories about how both my parents were kind of underachievers. So it was genetic. And what I realized as I began this work is, in fact, that whole story was basically a cover for fear that was related to my self-worth. And in particular, for me, was related to my intelligence. And, you know, in this sense, I'm a pretty good student at a pretty good university. So we could say objectively that I had intelligence. But that's different than what I felt on the inside and what I believed. And I was afraid that I couldn't succeed at this level, that I wasn't smart enough. So my fear of being stupid, and if we can get to this later, also really my fear of being stupid, I think this is often true, is actually a fear of not being really brilliant and really smart, caused me to delay things and put it off. And so I was being hijacked. I knew the right solution, Jeff, which was start early, get feedback, work on it. And then my behavior was something totally different. And it's because fear was creating stress, and that stress was causing me to avoid. And so as long as I was at the mercy of that fear, I'm not going to make progress. So that's a procrastination example. But this same framework applies to conflict avoidance, and also applies to more reactive behaviors like anger or being abrasive, you know, getting pulled into details, task oriented. A lot of these unhelpful behaviors that we have that we tend to think are personality are usually driven more by protecting our sense of self-worth in one way or another.
You talked about personality and I've often taken solace, I think, as many of us do, is that, well, that's something that's just part of our personality and can't be changed.
Right.
But these behaviors have been learned. And as you assert in the book, therefore, they can be unlearned, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So procrastination is a great example where it I don't know that anyone can believe more strongly than I believed that my procrastination was personality driven. Like, it was really completely my mental model around that. And I had a lot of judgment and even embarrassment, shame around that. And once I noticed that, in fact, because basically, Jeff, the way it works is I was afraid that if I started early and I did my best work and I turned in a paper and then I got a mediocre grade, that meant that I wasn't smart enough. My best work wasn't good enough. Yeah. Whereas I had a built-in excuse always that, well, the reason it wasn't better is because I have this unproductive personality flaw. So I was doing a trade-off, and we begin to see that our ego behaviors give us benefits. So the benefit to me was, it was something unwanted. It was poor results, but the benefit was it gave me an out. And this allows us to see how the behaviors that we tend to call personality traits that we don't like are actually behaviors that we're unconsciously committed to because they serve our comfort zone in a certain way. And so as I began to identify this and make my fear basically a failure more explicit, and noticing how it was causing me to move away from what was uncomfortable, I then was actually able to go into the heart of what I needed to do. And over time, that changed. And I would say probably today that one of my strengths in life is my ability to move forward on things that are uncomfortable, that I'm not sure how I'm going to do. So this fatal flaw has actually become a strength. And so in that sense, it can take a little while. It's not an overnight thing, but it's completely reversible if you want it.
Expound on this concept of these phrases you compare and contrast in, I think it's chapter 3 or 4 of the book, at the mercy versus at the source. How does that play into this?
So at the mercy is basically, we're trying to describe our state of being, like our experience of the present moment. Mm. And at the mercy is when we feel like outside circumstances or people are in some ways dictating our internal sense of calm and our well-being. So this can be chronic, like I feel stressed about work or finances or how many meetings I'm double booked at, or it can be chronic. My boss or the board just criticized me and I'm feeling acutely threatened. So we have negative emotions in that moment. And you can imagine in my scenario with the procrastination, I felt at the mercy when I had this thing due. Like, I just wish I didn't have this paper to write, because right now I'm just feeling at the mercy that I have to do it, and at the mercy of my own behavior that I'm not making more progress on it. And if you contrast that with at the source, I would describe it. So at the mercy, we can spend a lot of time in this space. Sometimes 90 to 98% of our waking life is feeling at the mercy of demands and kids and responsibility, deliverables. And whereas at the source, I think, is actually more our natural state. So think about our kids before they learn to be adults are often more at peace. They're in the present moment. They're simple. They're connected. They're asking questions. They're just showing up in their natural state of being that I think as adults we often lose. And so a lot of our work is around how when I want to change a behavior, it's not at the behavior that I have leverage. As long as I'm trying to force myself to do the thing that I'm afraid of doing, but I haven't resolved the fear that I'm feeling, I might be able to will myself for some short period of time to force a new behavior, but it's not going to be sustainable because I'm still at the mercy of all the tension that I carry. And often I just do it in other unproductive ways. Whereas if I can shift the underlying sources of tension and come back to more my natural state of curiosity and exploration and learning and connectedness, then often these personality, quote-unquote, behaviors tend to resolve themselves. I end up finding simple, more courageous ways to move forward because I'm not in this more reactive, at-the-mercy state.
And am I correct in understanding that when we're in that state, we often pull out of others the very behaviors we're trying and reactions instead of we're trying to avoid in the first place, sort of the self-fulfilling prophecy type idea, right?
So you're when I'm in the at the mercy state, you're saying?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. That's the thing that in some ways is both most troubling, but also perhaps our greatest leverage. So we feel at the mercy and we fall into these self-protective behaviors when we feel threatened. So if I feel like you're criticizing me or you're judging me, I'm going to feel in danger. And so I'm going to go into these automatic coping strategies, which might involve shutting down, withdrawing, criticizing you back, judging you. And if you think about these behaviors, we don't operate in a vacuum. So they affect other people. So if you and I work together and I'm feeling judged by you, and then I start judging you and then talking to my other colleagues about how Jeff is this way and he's that way because it makes me feel better. What I don't see is that you start feeling the effect of that. You start feeling like, well, Shane's after me and he's critical of me and he's judging me and that makes you feel more in danger. And so what do? You criticize me back and judge me more because now you think I've got an agenda against you. And this is how we get into unconscious spirals with other people. And this happens both in a one-on-one way. So two people who don't get along, who sort of get off on the wrong foot, if they don't clean it up, it can go downwards. And it also really happens in organizations between departments. So if you and I both lead teams that are, let's say, on opposite sides of a matrix, if you and I start getting out of whack with each other, we're liable to also talk to our respective teams about how the other person is this way or that way. And that begins to build up more of an us versus them dynamic. And I think what we see here is that when we're in an organization that has dysfunction or politics or turf wars, nobody wants it. Everybody hates it. Everybody feels like it's the other guy who's behaving improperly. And almost nobody sees how we're all inadvertently and involuntarily perpetuating the system. And so we're caught in a web that everyone would like out of.
It's always the other team's fault. Always.
Yeah. Yeah. And we kind of laugh about it. And from the outside, we say, oh, yeah, we always think it's the other team's fault. But when I'm in it, it really feels like the other team's fault.
Yeah. Yeah.
I got a lot of that to back now.
Trust me, I've been there. Both sides of that. Well, Shane, if you would, what has your experience taught you? And I thought there were some great examples of this in the book. What have your experiences taught you about the power of empathy and vulnerability in these work relationships?
Well, I think it's very related to what we're talking about. So when the reversal here, Jeff, is that when I feel in danger, when any of us feels in danger, most of our coping strategies and self-protective strategies, as we just discussed, end up generating threat for other people. So we trade threats back and forth unconsciously. And that just escalates until someone stops the cycle. And empathy and vulnerability are two of the most powerful ways to stop this cycle. So empathy is putting myself in the other person's shoes. So in our hypothetical scenario earlier, when you're judging me, instead of going, oh, Jeff is this way, I think, oh, he's a little defensive and aggravated there. What might be going on for him? There's probably some vulnerability he's feeling. And so for me to actually not involuntarily continue my cycle of reaction, but instead to actually see behind how the other person is visibly behaving and trying to understand what might be their feelings of vulnerability or insecurity that's behind that, so that I'm seeing behind the appearances to the underlying cause for the other person. And similarly, when I'm feeling threatened, I can act out my self-protective behaviors, which make me feel momentarily protected, but in fact cause this long tail of dysfunction. Or I can, through self-awareness, be able to identify, oh, right now I'm feeling like you're judging me as incompetent, or I'm feeling like I'm failing, or I'm feeling judged, and in fact express that. And the expression of that feels very vulnerable. It in particular feels vulnerable with colleagues or with teams where there's low trust. But in fact, it is the thing that begins to make the environment safe for other people to admit their vulnerability. And so vulnerability really is an act of courage that shifts the context from one of threat to one of safety and trust. And empathy is seeing that vulnerability in other people and then responding in ways that makes it safe for the other person to take that step of courage. And so the two really work in tandem in a very powerful way.
Would you say your work with the company outlined in the book, I think, is it Encore Capital?
Encore Capital, yeah.
I wanted to say Empire Capital for some reason. I knew that wasn't right. Would you say your work with them has been some of your most rewarding?
It was a very inspiring story. I felt very connected to the people on the team. There were definitely moments where it was bumpy and challenging. They're in the debt collection industry, so initially I had some reservations about working with them. And then in the end, I actually found it incredibly inspiring, because this was a business that is an industry that it's just very easy to judge as ill-intended and predatory. And they were really creating a culture where they were teaching people to actually care about the consumer and to have a goal for other people. Because the people that are in the debt collection system, they're trapped in something they don't know how to get out of. And if I'm a collector, I can just be with, well, how do I get more water out of this stone? Or I can be with, how do I help this person get back on their feet? And those two intentions caused me to see the consumer and lead from a very different starting point. And I'm not saying that Encore was perfect in their work and all of this, but nonetheless, it goes to the heart of how in everything that we do, we can have an intention for something broader than ourselves, or have an intention that's more around our self-worth. And up until now, we've been talking about self-worth very much as it's related to me and my behavior, but the goals that we take really matter. And so we can have what we call a noble goal, or a goal that's larger than myself in any situation. So I would say in that sense, it was a very inspiring journey. I suppose to really respond, like, what's most rewarding to me? Maybe the thing that I would just add is that I came to this work for very personal reasons, because I had a lot of emotional distress and dissatisfaction in my life, because my ego was so disruptive in my behaviors. Procrastination was but one of several things that were really not working for me. And I realized as I started this work that I was creating a lot of pain for myself and for other people through these behaviors. And I think what's most rewarding for me is not actually when an organization has a big breakthrough or performance enhancements like what is described in the book, but sometimes when people make shifts in their relationship with their children or their spouse or partner, because that's often what's most precious for people, and therefore what's most painful when there's disconnection.
How would you say working on your ego is the highest act of leadership in your view? Why is this one of the most important things we can do in regard to our leadership skills and our leadership future?
So I and all of us at Learning as Leadership, we came up with this statement together, and I think it's really connected to several things. One, you know, think about bosses you've had or colleagues you've had where you felt that they were really driven by their ego or were self-interested or, you know, just out for themselves. Like it really creates a sense of disconnection and distrust and, you know, second guessing. And by the way, they probably were no worse actually than you or I are. We just happen to do things that really pushed on our buttons, but I've got my own set of things. And so when any one of us is caught up, none of us wakes up in the morning wanting to go to work or into our life being driven by this, but it unconsciously drives the ship most of the time. And so it really has a negative effect on the quality of our relationships, on the level of trust in our organizations. Spread out across an organizational culture, it can really create toxicity, disconnection, turf wars. And so I tend to think that most organizations and teams operate somewhere well below 50% of their capacity, not because they could do more work or work more hours, but because a lot of their energy actually goes into avoidance, redundancy, judging, workaround, and a lot of people have a tremendous amount of work stress. And when you look at surveys around why people feel stress at work, it's usually not because there's too much work. It's because of painful, stressful relationships that feel dangerous to them. And so working on our ego and cleaning up our own stuff, and then therefore, A, not bringing that, but bringing something cleaner, more at the source, more centered, and then beginning to create an environment or a context where you help other people do that, actually transforms the effectiveness of a workplace. And it also brings, I think, a sense of wholeness and connection to people that is way more precious than a paycheck, because people spend a lot of time at work. And so we believe, and I believe, it's really our highest leverage as leaders.
Well, Shane, I have a couple of questions I want to ask you, not directly related to the book, but before I jump into that in the time we have remaining, is there anything else from the book you want to make sure that we know about?
So most of the book is the story of the CEO of Encore Capital, Brandon Black. But we have one chapter that is written by an executive on his team, Amy Anouk. And she shares her journey as a woman coming up in this company, and she felt passed over in many moments, and that there were hurdles that she had to jump through as a woman that a man wouldn't have, and that there were no women to teach her how to do that. And it was during our time that we were working there that Brandon and she finally began to talk about some of these dynamics, because he on his end thought that she was just a rising star who was, you know, had a straight to the top trajectory. And there was a real disconnect between his view and her view. And we delve into this challenge of being a woman and or a minority in a white male dominated workplace, and the difficulty of trying to dissect what's going on there and what happens, and also really the challenge of talking about it. Because for Amy to bring that up, it's a very delicate dance for Brandon to not hear, well, you're just saying that I'm a sexist or I passed you over. And I think that Amy just did an amazing job of sorting out in her own process what is perception and judgments versus what really is my path and what's holding her back, what she called her inner glass ceiling. And then also modeling how to how to put these issues on the table in a productive, generative way. And so that chapter was very meaningful for me. So I just wanted to say that we're not experts in that domain, but I think that this whole work on the ego and self-worth can really hijack the dialogues that we all have together around some of the more taboo or touchy topics in the workplace.
I really loved how you approached that chapter in it's chapter 7, I think. We Can't Talk About That, I believe is the name of it. One of my favorite chapters from the book, so I'm glad you brought that up. Well, I want you to think, Shane, if you can, about some of the books you've read over the years that have had a real impact on you, those titles that you come back to again and again as having impacted your career and impacted your life. What would you say those are?
Two pretty different books come to mind. Mm. One is a book that's had a lot of press, I think, especially under Obama, and that was Doris Goodwin's Team of Rivals. Mm. And I was just really inspired by that book and by her portrayal of Lincoln, because he appeared to me in the book to be someone who had some difficulties, frailties, vulnerabilities, plenty of moments where he could have easily felt betrayed or backstabbed or hurt by other people or not respected. So when I think about a leader who shows up aiming to be aware of and not involuntarily reacting to the slights that he or she may perceive, he was someone who seemed to be able to note that, put it aside, and empathize with, well, what might be going on for the other person? You know, if I'm not just going to prescribe ill intent to them, like, where are they coming from? Empathize with your enemy type of thing. And also have the larger goal in mind. And to be able to not lose sight of his purpose or his compass of what really matters because he's feeling aggressed or betrayed in some way. So I found that whole story, and there was all the rivals and different people, but the way Lincoln walked that path, I recall underlining a lot of passages. So that's one book. Do I have time to talk about a second?
Oh, sure, absolutely. Okay. The more the merrier.
Okay, the other one, completely different. So Elizabeth Gilbert, who I think is mostly known for Eat, Pray, Love, wrote a book called Big Magic that I think is tied to the TED Talk that she did around genius and where that comes from. I just found that book one of the more mentally and emotionally inspiring books I've read in the last decade. And she has a really interesting writing style. Like, it's short chapters that are somewhere between a page and three pages, simple sentences. But I found myself reading like 3 to 5 pages and then having to pause because I felt like I needed to absorb what she was saying. And I bring it up because it's connected. I think it struck a chord in me, because so much of our work and my life's path is around learning to identify how my preoccupation with my own competence and value is getting in the way of me being connected to other people, being open to my intuition, being not just intellectually connected to a sense of purpose, but feeling emotionally guided by it. And I thought, in very different language, she was really getting at how to get out of our own way and be open to the flow of ideas and inspiration and what we want in a way that was funny, accessible, pragmatic. So I dug that book a lot. Mm.
Well, I know your book has been out for 6 or 7 months now. I'd love to know what, if anything, that you and your team are working on now that you're excited about or able to talk about.
The recent development that we were excited about is that the audiobook just came out, I think, in the last week or two.
Okay.
We had a number of clients kept coming back to us saying, you need to do an audiobook. You need to do an audiobook. And so our publisher wanted us to have professional narrators, and we ended up deciding to have Brandon and Amy and I read our sections just because we felt it was connected to our wanting to offer something that was authentic and real for people. So if people are into audiobooks, that's actually us talking. And so it's probably not quite as perfect as it would be if it were professional narrators, but it's as real as we could make it. Other than that, right now, I only have the faintest rumblings of another book in the cooker. So there's nothing exciting like that going on. But we are constantly engaged with organizations, large and small, nonprofits, entrepreneurs, leaders from large organizations who are interested in doing this in-depth work for either themselves or their teams or organizations around the ego. So if in listening to this or reading the book, it strikes a chord around the things that are getting in your way. I see myself not as an expert in ivory tower, but really a practitioner, like the people out there working on my stuff every day and really looking to partner with people who want to create a different context around themselves, a different environment in their workplace and in their families. And so anyone who would like to connect on that level, we need less ego on the planet these days.
And you mentioned audiobooks. I tend to be drawn to audiobooks that are indeed read by the authors themselves versus books that are read by people like me. So I commend you for pushing back on that and insisting on reading the book yourselves. I think that's great. Well, the book again from Shane Hughes and Brandon Black is called Ego-Free Leadership, Ending the Unconscious Habits That Hijack Your Business. I really appreciate you taking the time, Shane. Thank you so much for writing it, and thank you so much for appearing on the show.
Well, thank you for having me, Jeff. I really enjoyed it.
On our show notes page, created especially for this episode, I've included a number of ways to connect with Shane and also the links and resources mentioned and discussed during our conversation. You can find all that at readtoleadpodcast.com/186 for episode 186. Remember to act quickly to find out more about submitting an application for my exclusive mastermind group launching next month. Send an email with mastermind in the subject line to jeff@readtoleadpodcast.com. Well, that's going to do it for this week. I look forward to seeing you next time for the next episode of the Read to Lead Podcast.
Thanks so much for listening to the Read to Lead Podcast. As a subscriber, we challenge you to be more than just a passive listener. Become a vital member of the community. Visit us on the web at readtoleadpodcast.com. Until next time, remember, leaders read and readers lead.